Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to this Monday, in fact, Labor Day edition of Catholic Answers Live. So happy to have you with us. I am Cy Kellett, your host. In our second hour, we'll talk about labor a bit. We'll talk about the Catholic Church's teaching on labor and our many labors with our own chaplain, Father Hugh Barber. This hour, we talk with two different angles on the 50th anniversary summer here that we have celebrated this year of Humanae Vitae, the very important encyclical of Pope Paul VI, and what that encyclical has meant, where it fits in the history of the Church, and why it is significant is our first topic that we cover this hour. And our guest to cover that topic with us is Dr. Alan Carson. Carlson. He's the author of 15 books and hundreds of articles on family questions, including most recently, Family Cycles, Strength, Decline, and Renewal in American Domestic Life. He is currently the John Howard Distinguished Senior Fellow at the International Organization for the Family. Dr. Alan Carlson, thank you for being with us.
I'm happy to be with you.
So we have you because you are one of the five perspectives in a book that Catholic Answers produced this summer called Inseparable, Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humanae Vitae. And you gave us a history lesson, extraordinary history lesson to close, to essentially close the book. And you begin that lesson with this sentence: the appearance of Humanae Vitae in 1968 was the most important religious and cultural event of the 20th century. That is an extraordinary sentence, and how do you justify it?
Well, it has to do with what was really going on in the world at that time. A darkness was descending over Western Christian civilization. It was not a new darkness. It was the same darkness that the early Christians confronted in the first and second century and beat it back by advancing the new morality of Christ relative to sexual and family questions. But it was coming back again. It had many different manifestations, but in the 1950s and 1960s, its newest manifestation was a push to sever the linkage between sexuality and procreation. All important, inseparable bond, hence the title of the book. And most of the Protestant churches had caved in by the 1960s, had accepted that, and opened themselves up to all that followed. The Roman Catholic Church was the one institution that was still in question. And Pope Paul VI, with the aid of a relatively small number of very bright men, turned back the tide, halted the advance of the darkness, and gave the rest of us a chance to mount a much more spirited and more effective counterattack against the darkness.
So your understanding then is that all of the – well, for example, in the United States, just a few years later, we had the Roe versus Wade decision, and the Catholic Church position opposing that decision and really leading the – when there was virtually no other opposition, kind of leading the creation of the opposition to abortion in the United States at that time, and the defense of marriage and family, all of that that followed, the germ or the seed, the beginning of that plant that has sprouted over the last 50 years is Humanae Vitae.
Well, that's right. In a sense, Humanae Vitae bought us time.
I see.
Now, if the Pope had caved in, and he was under tremendous pressure in the mid-1960s to cave in and at least accept the birth control pill as consistent with historic Catholic teaching. If he had caved in, we wouldn't be talking today. The issues would pretty much be over. We two Christians, those still trying to adhere to Christian moral standards regarding sexuality and family, would be literally hiding in caves. We're pretty close to that, but the reason we're still fighting and have a chance to win, in fact, I think we'll win, is because the Pope Paul VI, took his stand in 1968, shocked the world in doing so, and made a witness to the created order and to Christian truth.
Can you give us a sense of that moment? I mean, when you say shocked the world, it really did. I mean, I have to tell you, I was only 4 years old at the time. I don't remember it. It really did reverberate as a shock throughout the world?
Entirely. Again, you have to look at the context. Virtually all of the the Protestant churches around the world by that point had adopted some form of support for birth control, for active artificial birth control. Now, that had not been true 40 years earlier. Not a single Protestant church anywhere on the globe had endorsed birth control. There was a Christian unity on that question that was 1,900 years old, going all the way back to the very earliest records we have of Christianity, including the Gospels, of course, and the epistles. But that unity had been broken, and there seemed to be like an overwhelming tide to accept birth control. It's just something that had to come now. Its time had come. The old views were antiquated, no longer true, no longer correct. New readings of the passages in the Bible had come along saying, well, they really didn't mean what they appear to mean. It means something different. Again, the tide was rolling. Yeah. And within the Catholic Church itself, there was a commission to study the birth control and related questions, initially launched by Pope John the 23rd, augmented by Paul the VI, and just because of the person selected, there was a majority of the members by the mid-60s were in favor, again, of joining the Protestant churches in this surge to embrace birth control. Again, Paul the VI and several close advisors, including his Cardinal Ottavian and two American theologians, John C. Ford and Germain Griset, came back and with a series of documents convinced Paul the VI that the historic truths of the church were still true, nothing had changed,
yes.
And in fact that a darkness was descending, and pretty much it was his duty at this point, his obligation, to raise the flag of Christian truth in the face of this new charge of a very old heresy.
And when you say a very old heresy, you go quickly in your the piece that you have in the book Inseparable is called A Prophetic Witness to Creation, and you go very quickly back to take us back to the origins the origins are in Christ himself of the Catholic teaching on sexuality, of the Christian teaching on sexuality, but in the early Roman Empire, into which this new understanding of human sexuality was introduced, it bore some similarities to today.
Very much so. In fact, it was almost identical. And just about anything you want to mention, the marriage system of the Romans by the first century AD was in shambles. It was the average age of marriage for a young woman was about 12 or 13, marrying men much older. The infanticide was widespread and widely practiced. There was a male-female imbalance among adults in Rome, about 140 males to every 100 females, which came from killing baby girls after they were born. Abortion was widely practiced and considered legitimate and appropriate, although quite unsafe. Many Roman women died as a result of botched abortions or were left permanently sterile. Practice of Greek love of men and adolescent boys was widespread and accepted. Prostitution, both male and female, was widespread and accepted. A turn towards weird and strange forms of sexual behavior, things we would today call transsexualism, again, quite accepted in the Roman culture of the time. Again, the old virtues of the Roman Republic were long gone. And it was into this mix that the followers of Jesus came with this startling new morality, One of the most startling things to people at the time was that Jesus condemned sexual misbehavior among men as well as among women. There was no double standard when it came to fidelity within marriage. Now, that was a totally at odds with every other human culture existing at the time. That's just to choose one example. Jesus' protection of human life from the very beginning and condemnation of abortion, condemnation of divorce, these were all startling, radical ideas. And that's what the Christians brought with them, and that's what was that heritage was still there in the 20th century, but the old heresies came back again to try to challenge it.
It's an extraordinary story. I want to dig into it a little bit more. I'm particularly interested in how the Romans saw these Christians and what they were up to and what this was all about. We do have to take a quick break. We'll take a quick break and be right back with more. I want to let you know that Catholic Answers magazine is on sale right now. You can get a full year subscription for your student at just $24.95. It's the lowest price in years, and it's for students because we know students going back to school face all kinds of questions and challenges to their faith, and that's what Catholic Answers magazine is designed to confront and help them work their way through. CatholicAnswersMagazine.com is where you go. You put in the promo code MSchool, and you get that price, $24.95 for a year subscription for your student.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
Every single day, I get to help our listeners of the Sunrise Morning Show wake up, find out what's going on in the church and the world, and then walk with them as we all seek to grow in knowledge and love of Jesus Christ and the Catholic faith. I mean, how could it get any better?
The Sunrise Morning Show with Anna Mitchell and Matt Swaim. Tomorrow morning, 6 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back, and a very happy and blessed Labor Day to you and your family. Thanks for joining us on this Labor Day afternoon at Catholic Answers Live. We're talking with Dr. Alan Carlson this hour about a kind of a history lesson about how Christianity arrived at the sexual mores that it has, and why Pope Paul's the defense of those in Humanae Vitae was so important to the history of the world. I was enjoying my conversation with you so much. We had only gotten up to the early years of the Christian incursion into the Roman Empire. So you've set the stage for us of a time when really family life was profoundly corrupt in the early Roman Empire. And sexual matters were in a disordered state. And here come these Christians. How were those Christians perceived, and what were the battles that they had to fight, both within Christianity and within the empire more generally?
Well, from the very early times, when they numbered no more than maybe 20 or 30,000, they were seen as scapegoats. When there was a fire in Rome, the Emperor Nero blamed the Christians, a very famous story on that. But they were small in number. Most Romans saw the Christians as a strange little group coming out of the Middle East, perhaps a burial society, kind of like a mutual insurance fund, and had their ritual meals with wine and bread and so on. But very early on, too, the Christian church, which had this sexual ethic firmly in place by the end of the first Christian century, faced the infiltration of heresies into their ranks. The Gnostics, a very old concept, the Christian version of it stressed that the mind and the body were separate. I mean, one of the beauties of the natural law, the Christian understanding of natural law, is that the human being is an integrated unity. The mind and the body are both necessary and absolutely vital and essential. The Gnostics said, no, the body is sinful, it's corrupted. The mind is all that matters, and we have to free the mind from the body. Without of going into details, that led to a whole series of corruptions, including sexual corruptions of some of the most horrific sort. Gnostics infiltrated the early Christian church. They were finally driven out after about two centuries of work. Another movement, the Manichaeans, again, a similar view of the human body as corrupted, that, too, threatened the early church. In the 10th and 11th centuries, the Bogomil heresy, which was kind of a rebirth of Gnosticism and Manichaeanism all rolled together. Again, an attack on the human body, an attack on the human spirit, and ultimately it led to very direct assaults on the sexual ethic of the Christians. These were all beaten back. What happened then in the 20th century, again, is that the Gnosticism came back again. We saw it in things such as the population control movement, which cast human life as a cancer on the earth. We see it in an attempt to separate sexuality from the mind. And in fact, as we now say today, that gender is all that matters, and there's 57 genders or 157 genders, and you choose your own. That's, again, a very Gnostic idea. All of these things were swirling around in the 60s. The Protestant churches, by and large, had succumbed to them, and again, the Roman Catholic Church at that point, and the Western world stood alone.
And so here we this happened very quickly, and is it a moral revolution that's the child of a technological revolution? I mean, does this all come down to the pill? Why this all changed, or is there more to that story?
No, there's much more to it. In fact, well, the pill is a highly effective form of birth control, but also a very distorting form. It's kind of a form of chemical warfare on the human genome pool, but that's a different story. The issues were taking place long before the pill had been invented. Again, the Anglican Church embraced birth control in 1930. Part of the reason they did that was for eugenic reasons. They wanted to control the births of people who weren't desirable. When Pius XI issued his Casti Canubi, his encyclical on human sexuality, which reaffirmed Catholic opposition to birth control, he noted the linkage of the birth control movement to the eugenics movement, which was very strong, even, in fact, particularly strong within the Protestant churches, where some really quite weird things were being printed about Christ as the first eugenicist and so on. The battle was going on before the pill was introduced. The significance of the pill for the debate was that there were some prominent Catholic voices who said, "Well, the pill is different. We can kind of bend the truth a little bit. It's compatible with Catholic teaching, say in a way that other forms of artificial birth control are not." But no, the issue was well on its way before the pill emerged in 1960.
So again, I want to go. So that year 1968, where you said was such a shock that Pope Paul VI did what he did. In part, that must be because already inroads had been so significantly made into Christian communities with this idea of separating procreation and marriage. You wrote a book called "Godly Seed: American Evangelicals Confront Birth Control." What happened in the among American Protestants? Was there and who are the heroes and maybe villains of that story?
Well, unfortunately, there aren't too many heroes in the '60s, in fact, even we'll call conservative evangelicals, the group that became sort of the new Christian right in the '70s and '80s, the group around Christianity Today, the followers of the Billy Graham ministry. The very summer when Humana Vitae was issued, they held their own large meeting. All the prominent evangelical theologians and scholars were there, and they came out with a document called Affirmations, which embraced not just birth control, but also embraced legalized abortion, embraced sterilization, embraced national and international programs of population control, all up and down the line. That document is an indictment, but also a testimony to what was happening more broadly. Again, it emerged about 2 weeks before Pope Paul's encyclical emerged. And again, the two are just in shocking contrast. Yeah. What came out of it, though, was good. Within a few years, American evangelicals abandoned most of the positions in the document affirmations, all except for birth control, which they sort of quietly continued to support. But they became mostly pro-life. They stopped supporting programs of population control. Again, none of that would have happened if Paul had caved at the same time.
Did a similar process happen within the Catholic Church? It's certainly the case that the Church struggled mightily with Humanae Vitae throughout the 1970s and 80s. It's just that Catholics don't go off and form a different evangelical church down the street in general. They either stay Catholic and just fight over the meaning of the church, or they leave the church. Did that happen?
Well, sure. And you know the statistics. I mean, I think they tend to be exaggerated, but what proportion of Catholics of childbearing age follow the church's teaching? Well, a significant proportion do, but it's probably not a majority. It's a significant minority. They struggle with it. What's different is that Humanae Vitae stands out there as a beacon of life and of truth, of light and of truth. You have to grapple with it. And even if you reject it, I imagine that comes with a guilty conscience. It's there. And again, it's entirely consistent with 1,900 years of Christian consensus. Even the Eastern Orthodox churches, particularly since they have been liberated from communism, the communist yoke, reaffirm the truths that are found in Humanae Vitae and have reaffirmed their defense of human life and have reaffirmed their defense of their opposition to birth control and the mentality it creates. Again, Humanae Vitae bought time for the Eastern Orthodox churches to recover their bearings in a politically difficult century.
Now, going forward, if we accept the premise that we live now in an increasingly pagan, Gnostic world, what is the course? What course does that suggest to us as a future course of action in regard to maybe wanting to do what our earliest forebears in the Christian Church did, which was convince the world to accept Christ's teaching on human sexuality?
Well, what the Christians did in the first, second, and third centuries, to a considerable degree, was went about their business. Went about their business and lived their lives in conformity with Christian teachings on these matters. One of the results was that they quite simply outbred the Romans. In 100 AD, the number of Christians in the world was probably about 40,000 at most. By 300 AD, their number had increased to about 35 million, a dramatic increase. Some of that came from conversions, but the evidence is strongly suggestive that probably the greatest share of it simply came because Christians, living through their lives in conformity with Christian teachings, had more babies, had stronger marriages, and more of the children survived to adulthood than was true among the pagans. If you'll forgive the phrase, they outbred, they out-familized
right.
the pagans. And I guess you'd say, in a sense, Christians are called to do that again. It's the same darkness. Nothing is new. There are no new temptations that have been invented. They're the same ones that faced the Roman world. And the same sorts of heresies that crept into the early church. Nothing has changed except the details. So the same this battle is going on again, and I think Christians need to become more aware of what was going on in the first couple of centuries. Actually, it's kind of an exciting opportunity.
Yeah, it is indeed. But I wonder if the authorities, like I'm thinking of China, for example, with the technologies that we have now of monitoring people and controlling people, that there's the totalitarian impulse will be to say, no, this happened before, that they outbred us. We won't allow it this time.
Well, Just remember, many thousands of Christians died martyrs' deaths, witnessing to the truths we're talking about. And that may happen again. That didn't stop them. They went about it. You're right, there are new dangers. We'll see how it plays out. But I'm more optimistic. And I'm not talking about quiescence. This doesn't mean retreating into our own little world and kind of hope we'll be left alone. You still have to be politically engaged, and you still have to be as wise, as wise as foxes and facing the contemporary challenges you face, and you can't shrink from that. But it does mean be confident in the truths that have been passed down to us. They come from Christ. They come from the Church Fathers. They come from the Church Universal for 1,900 years. That's where you stand, and that's what you need to stand by.
Dr. Alan Carlson, thank you so much for an enlightening half hour. For anybody who would like a look at the history of human sexuality and where Humanae Vitae fits in it, get this book, Inseparable. Read Dr. Carlson's article. Thank you again, Dr. Carlson, for just a fantastic, enlightening half hour.
You're welcome.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
Is the Church wrong on contraception? In a culture that worships the pursuit of sexual pleasure, the Catholic Church's teaching on contraception can seem archaic and unintelligible. Its critics say it's outdated, theologically unfounded, and even harmful. And even faithful Catholics can have difficulty explaining this moral teaching. Catholic Answers is out to change all of that. That's why we've just released Trent Horn's dynamic new DVD, The Case Against Contraception. Using scripture, papal and magisterial teachings, natural law, and new insights provided by social science and medicine, Trent puts forward a compelling case for Catholic teachings with his trademark charity and persuasive graciousness. Be prepared to give a defense. Order your copy of The Case Against Contraception today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
With the recent commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the release of Humanae Vitae, there have been fresh attacks on Catholic teaching from outside and, unfortunately, inside the Church. That's why Catholic Answers thought it critical to provide a vigorous affirmation of Paul VI's prophetic wisdom with our newest book, Inseparable, 5 Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humanae Vitae. We asked 5 distinguished contributors to reflect on and defend Humanae Vitae from 5 perspectives, each of them compelling, together forming a mosaic of truth. Don't be caught uninformed when the topic of contraception comes up among friends, family, and coworkers. Order your copy of Inseparable today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or visiting the shop at Catholic.com.
Choosing a child's godparents can be a difficult task.
Let's discuss how to make this important decision on tomorrow's Take 2 with Jerry and Debbie at noon Eastern.
Now let's get back to Cy Kellett and more of Catholic Answers Live.
Hey, very happy Labor Day to you and yours as we continue with our Labor Day programming here on Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being with us. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Don't forget, next hour, our chaplain, Norbertine Father Hugh Barber, will be here, and we're going to talk about labor. We're going to talk about the Catholic Church's understanding of human labor and how that has developed over time and what the teaching is today. So please join us for that. This hour, we continue our conversation on Humanae Vitae and human sexuality more generally, especially in this modern or postmodern era, whichever you prefer. And our guest for this half of the hour is Dr. Paul Gondreau. He's a professor of theology at Providence College in Rhode Island. He's the author of a whole bunch of scholarly works on marriage and human sexuality and on Christology, with a particular specialization in the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas. He was formerly a consultant to the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Laity, Marriage, Family, and Youth. Dr. Paul Gondreau, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. My pleasure to be with you, Cy.
So in this book from Catholic Answers, Inseparable, 5 Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humanae Vitae, you got the philosophical task, I suppose, the natural – you were there to defend or explain to us the natural law.
Absolutely. What is important for all Catholics to understand is that the Church's moral teaching is not addressed typically simply to Catholics, that is to say to confessed believers, but it's an understanding of moral living that is grounded in our humanity as such and can be articulated on the basis of our very human design. And so one is able to make arguments or to come to understand what constitutes morally appropriate behavior, in this case in the sexual arena of human life, on the basis of reason alone. And Paul VI makes that clear in the very address of Humanae Vitae, in that he addresses it to certainly to Catholics, but then he says to all people of goodwill.
It does. I guess we can ask, how much are people of goodwill listening? You use the term you took from Tolkien at a certain point in the Lord of the Rings, where we can come to the point where we have turned towards madness and evil, and it feels like a moment of madness and evil in the current understandings or lack of understandings in the realm of human sexuality.
That's certainly the case, isn't it? I mean, just take an analogous case of the case of abortion, which, let's be frank, it's rather easy to show how immoral that is on the basis of the human conscience alone. And yet, that it remains legal, that it remains a highly controverted topic, just shows that when you're talking about sex in particular, often, unfortunately, the problem is not simply one of faulty reasoning, but it's really a corruption of the heart. And so, unfortunately, you can't just win people over by a strict argument. There's something deeper, a deeper corruption, certainly, that's at play. And so a whole conversion is often needed in the case of, certainly in the case of the Catholic vision of human sexuality. This is something I find all the time in the classroom, that run up against this, that people are implicated personally. They're often compromised themselves by how they live. And this really, really clouds how they approach the matter.
And so you may use the words natural law, but you find that there's a kind of smirking about this idea of natural law today, that there's a kind of sense of you're nuts or you're a reactionary if you believe in natural law.
Isn't it the case, that I remember back in the day when Clarence Thomas, the current Supreme Court justice, when he was nominated to the Supreme Court, what made all the news was that he was a so-called natural law proponent, and it sent shudders down the mainstream media. And what could this, what a throwback, what a dinosaur, how could anyone in the end of the 20th century believe that? But on the other hand, I mean, what we're talking about is by natural law, we don't mean anything other than the fact that there are certain moral parameters of what constitutes good human behavior and bad human behavior. And most every human being agrees to that. All you need to do is ask someone, what about rape? Do you need to be a religious believer to think rape is wrong, or do you just need to be a person with a functioning conscience? That's what natural law is.
Indeed. But I imagine at a university and even at a Catholic university, you must have students come in who have been fully catechized into you give a whole list of words there that you have, that you can kind of identify for yourself what you are: transgender, genderqueer, agender, bigender, third gender, gender fluid, and it goes on and on like that. Do you have to kind of break through that catechesis today in order to even begin to talk about the natural law?
That's exactly the challenge that I find, that as the culture just continues to go over the cliff, and that the more our students get brainwashed, and the more they just get this totally hedonistic, totally pleasure first view of sexual activity pounded into them from the get-go, that gender, you know, for instance, has no strict relation to biology. And so let's get our students in the third grade thinking about whether their gender is something different than their biology. That this is becoming ever increasingly difficult to break through. And I've just found, you know, so for instance, I teach a course on marriage to undergraduates. And I have, every year I teach it, I just kind of wonder, has the culture just gone so far gone now that say 3 months, because the way I approach it is I got 3 months to just, you know, I got a couple cracks a week over the course of a semester. I just keep outlining this vision of human happiness, of human flourishing, and how our sexuality relates to that. And over the course of a semester, that sometimes can finally penetrate. But these days, I'm wondering, you know, as the culture just gets worse and worse, madness and evil, again, the line from The Lord of the Rings, is that just becoming a pipe dream, or if not, just ever more difficult? And I think it is, actually.
So it seems like the strategy that you have, and it's one that you employ in your essay, The Meaning and Purpose of Human Sexuality, in the book Inseparable, is to not just say, contraception is wrong and here's the natural law reasons why, but to move a step back in a sense and say, look, there are competing visions of what a human being is, and as you just said, what human happiness is, and you need to maybe at least propose to us and to your students, consider these first before you try to settle moral questions. Am I getting at the strategy?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. That what I'm really always trying to show is that the debate over sexual practices, sexual lifestyle, sexual relationships, it's expressive of a deeper debate over what it means to be human. And ultimately, what your understanding of what it means to be human is will determine what you think is right or wrong in terms of sexual practice, whether one is consciously aware of that or not. So that, for instance, if you say that you can treat your body however you want, you know, you can treat it like a toy, you can treat it like a recreational playground, and that good, the good of pleasure, trumps everything else, then really what you're saying deep down in a more, assuming at least at a deeper anthropological level, is that the human body is just a plaything and is thus not an integral part of our human identity, and you can use it however you please instead of as an integral part of your human identity. It carries inherent moral worth and dignity, and you must therefore treat your body as you treat your very own personhood.
Now, I would just take a moment of discursus here with you just to ask you, when you read Humanae Vitae, do you see the Pope doing that, offering a different view of what it is to be a human, or is he simply holding the line there, and then we have to wait for later popes and developments to give us that fuller view of a proposition of what a human being is in its fullness?
I think it's more the latter there, Cy. And that's why that was what I was trying to do in my essay with Inseparable, is to show that you know, Humanae Vitae, it's a very short document, and it just, you know, in quite minimal terms, draws the lines of what constitutes sexually appropriate behavior, with a specific focus on contraception. But you find principles that are employed there, core principles, and you find implicit, in the very least, a certain anthropological understanding of the human person to allow, you know, someone like myself to come along, or someone like Pope John Paul II. Recall that the theology of the body was itself, by his own admission, when he started the catechetical weekly addresses that came to be called the theology of the body, John Paul II made it very clear that his purpose was to flesh out the fuller meaning and purpose of human sexuality that contained kind of inchoately in Humanae Vitae. So it was just, he took 5 years.
He took
5 years to flesh out Humanae Vitae.
Right.
And so what I'm doing in my essay is I'm approaching it from a slightly different angle, a properly philosophical one, and showing what vision of the human person really stands behind the teaching.
And it's that vision of the human person that I'd like to spend some time with you developing for our listeners today. But we have to take a quick break, so we'll do that. And then I want to get to that question. What is the the image, the understanding of the human person that undergirds all of this teaching in Humanae Vitae and the Church's teaching on sexuality more generally. Before I send you off to break, listener, I will let you know that Legla Miller's and Trent Horn's book, Made This Way, is almost out. It'll be out in a couple weeks. It's a book on how to prepare kids to face today's tough moral issues. And the idea is that Trent and Legla talked as parents and as philosopher theologians about some of the most important moral issues of our day, and then give you ideas about how to start actual conversations with your kids about them. Because as we've been discussing, your school is having these conversations and the media is having these conversations. We as Catholic parents need to have these conversations and have them effectively. So go to shop.catholic.com and reserve your copy today. Book will be out soon.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
Well, I don't think we're like the typical college students, because we really hang out at our campus ministry and everything. It's amazing about how much more connected you feel. We share really cool articles from actually you guys, EWTN, and like what you were saying about evangelization. So that's really nice.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Happy Labor Day. Hope you can get a hot dog maybe today, or a little potato salad or something. Yeah, Labor Day is good for that, Nick. It's not just a Memorial Day. Labor Day, you get to go have that last summer barbecue. And we're so happy to have you here with us as we discuss a very important issue this hour, human sexuality. We're having conversations with a couple of the authors from the book Inseparable, Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humanae Vitae. This hour, we're taking the natural law perspective with Dr. Paul Gondreau, a professor of theology at Providence College in Rhode Island. And we have established thus far that we are not just talking about two different ways of thinking about the pill, or about some technology, or the application of technology in our sex lives and all that. We're not. We're talking about two different ways of conceiving what a human being is. So I want to give you some time, Dr. Gondreau, to kind of propose to us again, as you do in your essay, a healthier, more whole, and fully Catholic understanding of what the human being is.
Sure, Si, happy to do that. So really, what I would say, what I would put my finger on, the source of the debate, is the role and the part, the place that the human body has to play in our human identity. Okay, so the anthropology that the Catholic Church has always favored, and you find it articulated certainly in the Catechism, you find it articulated in certain councils of the Church, is that the human person is a body soul unity, and so we are identified as much with our body, which is biologically materially designed, as with our soul, which itself is spiritual. It's immaterial. It's not physical. So we are quite the paradoxical creation, really a beauteous wonder of God's creation, that we are this paradoxical union, composite union of matter and spirit, of body and soul, right? And so that means then that God, designing us this way, intends us to live in accordance with that design. And the way that relates to our sexuality is in a particularly powerful way, because if we look at human sexuality, the first thing that we need to see here and to acknowledge is that this is owing to us first and foremost because of our bodies, our biologically designed bodies, whereby we are linked to the animal kingdom. So like animals, we propagate by way of sexual union. And That, which is to say then, that looked at from a purely physical or biological point of view, there's no way to make sense of human sexuality, what its purpose is, if we abstract procreation out of the picture, that it is essentially ordered to procreation. However, of course, we're not just animals. We are rational animals. Again, we have these animal-like bodies that are profoundly intimately joined to a soul, to a rational soul. And it's in virtue of that rational soul that we are ordered to higher goods than just what we can enjoy in the physical plane, such as food, drink, sex. But we are ordered ultimately to love, to relationships. And this is why then that when it comes to our sexuality, that the church has identified and Paul VI in Humanae Vitae certainly identifies this. We speak of an ordering to love, to loving union, to companionship. You find it in the Bible too, where in the first creation account, God makes us male and female and commands us to multiply and fill the earth. So he makes us male and female for the very obvious purpose of procreation. But in the second creation account, he creates Eve to be a companion to Adam so that he can finally look at someone and say, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. So sexuality, therefore, is ordered to that unique union where two persons who are able to unite physically in such a way that procreation is able to result are at the same time one body and one flesh, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. And so what we find then in Humanae Vitae, number 12, is Paul VI saying that there is this inseparable connection, hence the name of the book, Inseparable, this inseparable connection between the procreative and the unitive orderings. And what I'm saying is that inseparable connection is best understood in light of the fact that there is inseparable union between body and soul, so that the ordering of our sexuality to procreation follows especially upon our having bodies, and our ordering to unit of love is owing especially to our having rational souls. And so long as one cannot separate body from soul, neither can we separate the procreator from the unitive. And if you just look at what Catholic moral teaching lists as those sexual practices that violate God's meaning and purpose of human sexuality, you can see right there that it's an attempt to have one of those orderings at the expense of the other, usually the unitive at the expense of the procreative, whether it's contraception or same-sex activity. Or on the other score, you've got the procreative at the expense of the unitive in the case of artificial methods of reproduction. So anthropologically speaking, then, really this is the debate is, can these orderings, the procreative and the unitive be separated? And if you argue that they can, as the culture does, then really at bottom what you're saying is that and usually it's by way of snickering at the procreative ordering, looking upon our biologically structured body as a kind of albatross that weighs us down, and if we could just somehow use technology to suppress that and to master the order of nature, then really we've attained the heights of human excellence. And really what this is at bottom saying is that the human being is really just a thinking, choosing self, only loosely tied to a body, and the body has no essential moral bearing on our actions.
It does, but there's the other position too, the one that says we're not a soul at all. We're just a body, and therefore the we don't have to worry about higher moral questions at all.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. So, what really the anthropology that the church has always appropriated and favored falls between these two extremes.
Yeah.
All right. That you've got on the one extreme. What I would call, I often call it a Cartesianist anthropology, named after the father of modern philosophy, René Descartes, who famously defined the human being as a thinking, choosing self. But on the other extreme is this materialist anthropology that sees the human being as nothing more than just a material construct. Ironically, though, even though these are two extremes opposed to each other side, they lead to the same moral consequences, right? Because on the one case, in the case of the human being, is just a thinking, choosing self loosely tied to a body. Well, then you can do whatever you want with your body. And on the other extreme, with the human being being nothing more than a body, well, then the body has no more inherent moral worth and dignity. And thus, you can also do whatever you want with it. So it leads to the same, at least practical consequences.
And those practical consequences, you use the word dehumanizing at one point or at several points in the essay. What is dehumanizing about this, or what are the practical ways in which we are, our humanity is attacked or diminished by this?
Well, there you go. That this is why I like to keep coming back to the really the ultimate question is, what does human happiness, human flourishing, consist in terms of sexual practice? And from the perspective that I'm outlining, the Catholic perspective, it means to act in accordance with our fundamental humanity. And thus, to act in opposition to that is to act in dehumanizing ways. It's to act in a way that is beneath our humanity. Either we reduce our actions to those that are really no different than animals. I mean, if we just could pursue sex as that order to whose good that we're ordered to is pleasure, the highest good. Well, then tell me how we're different from animals. Tell me really. I mean, that's what animals do.
Right.
But on the other hand, we don't want to expunge the bodily dimension of human life from good moral living, because this is how God has designed us. So we need to see the fact that God is, he's designed us to enjoy certain bodily goods, but these are not ends in themselves. These are not ultimate goods. These are subordinate to higher goods. And so to act in a way that is respectful of our humanity, and thus in truly humanizing ways, is to pursue these goods as interim goods, as indeed subordinated to higher goods, so that as kind of stepping stones. And what gets us into trouble is when we stunt that, when we pursue these bodily goods as ends in themselves, as if that's what's going to satisfy the deepest yearning of the human heart for happiness. Anything less than the highest good to which we are ordered, which of course is God Himself, anything less is to pursue as a good in which we can find our happiness is to dehumanize ourselves, and which is to say that it's just to undermine our own desire and quest for happiness and flourishing.
And in a sense, we end up rejecting the gifts that God has given us. I wonder how many young women in your classes see pregnancy or the potential for pregnancy as an obstacle to their goals and their sense of well-being. Is that a common thread among young women?
Oh, well, that certainly is what the culture is selling on them, isn't it? That you need to look upon your biology and your ability to get pregnant as inimical to your self-expression, to your self-worth, And so, on the other hand side, it's interesting that when I get to natural family planning, interestingly, this is, would you believe that this is sometimes the thing that gets students to kind of embrace the Catholic vision?
I'm impressed. I want to know how that works.
Well, of course, I end with that. I go through the other issues first, and then I end by getting to contraception and natural family planning. But they're, on the one hand, they are disposed for it, because we're living in an age of organic living, of clean living. And, so I will pitch natural family planning as kind of green birth control, or ecological birth control. But more deeply, I'm impressed by how well informed my female students especially are with how noxious, toxic the pill especially is. And they see, I will just ask them, how many of you know someone who's been put on the pill by their OBGYN because they had some menstrual irregularity, and they almost raise your hand. Okay, then I'll say, how many of you know someone, either yourself or someone, who suffered some ill side effects from being on the pill? And lots of hands always go up. So they are ready for a teaching which comes in to say, first, you know, this is why, morally speaking, this is why, this, let me explain why this is different from contraception, why this is morally good, provided one does it with the right intentions. You can, you know, you can use it with the wrong intentions, the so-called contraceptive mentality. It's true, but in itself, it's fundamentally different from a moral point of view. But then let me tell you, just, you know, in a kind of snapshot view, how it works. And I do have to say,
Dr. Gundreau, I'm sorry we are out of time, but we'll have to end on that positive note. I'm glad young people are receptive to this. Dr. Gundreau, thank you so much for a wonderful half hour.
You're welcome. My pleasure to be with you, Cy.
We'll be right back with a discussion on labor on this Labor Day on Catholic Answers Live.